Reading from Isaiah 59, verses 4 and verses 14 and 15. No one calls for justice, nor does any plead for truth. They trust in empty words and speak lies. They conceive evil and bring forth iniquity. Justice is turned back, and the righteousness stands afar off. For truth has fallen in the street, and equity cannot enter. So truth fails, and he who departs from evil makes himself a prey. When the Lord saw it, it displeased him that there was no justice. John chapter 14, verse 6. Jesus said to him, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me.
Good morning, everyone. It's good to see everyone again after my absence last week. As you know, I had an aunt that passed away, and her funeral was last Monday. And I have to tell you, it was one of the few funerals I've ever been to where there was absolutely no crying at all. My aunt was a wonderful lady, one that was loved by so many people. And the funeral was a celebration of her life. She died in the Lord, and everybody knew that. And actually, it was more a time of laughter and joy and sharing good time with the cousins and other relatives, people that all knew and loved her. And it was just a wonderful time to reconnect with folks I hadn't seen some in quite some time. And I appreciate so much Larry filling in for me last Sunday. I know he did an excellent job. And it's just a reminder of how brief our time upon this earth is. You come away from an event like that recognizing, you know, I don't have much time left. I better make the most of it while I can. It's good to see some who are visiting with us here today. We, as always, are so delighted to have you with us and encourage you to be back at any time you have an opportunity to do so in the future. Today we're going to begin a new series, a rather short series of lessons that I call Answering Critics. There are so many accusations that are hurled against believers, charges that we face from those who are quite antagonistic toward Christianity, and increasingly we live in a society that is dominated by this kind of thought. Growing up, I lived in a society and a culture in which virtually everybody called themselves a Christian in some form or another. But today, that picture has changed dramatically. If you call yourself a Christian, you are an outlier. You're the oddball. You're the kook. Most people, or a good number of people in our society today, have no faith in God whatsoever. They do not see the Bible as the Word of God. They think Christianity is largely a joke. And some people mount rather vigorous efforts to try to discredit Christianity. And if you talk and visit with people very much at all out in the world, no doubt you have from time to time encountered some of these criticisms that are offered against Christianity. So what I'd like for us to do over the next few weeks is to take up one by one some of the more common complaints that people have about the Christian faith and try to respond to those criticisms as best we can. It's very easy for us to adopt the attitude, well, these are people who don't believe in God. These are people who have an attitude problem. These people just don't have faith. That's their problem. Well, that may be true, but they still deserve an answer. And if we are to have any hope or expectation of reaching these people, we have to learn how to take these criticisms seriously and to be able to answer them with courtesy and respect and compassion, and do so in a way that the critics can understand and appreciate the answer that we give. Just simply spouting scripture to them, which is what we are accustomed to doing among ourselves, that really doesn't carry much weight with them. And for that reason, I'll just give you a heads up that you'll find long stretches of this series or the individual lessons in this series, I won't mention very many scriptures at all. Because if people do not believe there is a God, if they do not believe the Bible is the Word of God, if they do not believe that Jesus is the Son of God, then how much weight does simply quoting scripture to them carry? It's not going to convince them. So like Paul at Athens in Acts 17, we have to meet the people where they're at. If people come to us with rather harsh criticisms of what we believe and what we represent, we have to be prepared to meet them on their ground and to try to reason with them why we believe and why we hold to something that we feel is so important to us in this life. Our goal in this series is not to defeat an enemy. Our goal instead is to win hearts to the truth that we think is important to us and that should be important to others. Our first lesson that we're going to deal with today has to do with the subject of truth. Now, you might think going into a series like this that the most logical place to start is God. Is there a God? And if so, what is he and so forth? And I understand the rationale there. But I've become more and more convinced that before people can really talk about the evidence for or against the existence of God, there's something else that lies deeper. There are some other assumptions that are more bedrock to how people are thinking than whether or not they believe that God exists. And it relates to the subject of truth. What is truth? And how can we know truth? And the complaint that people usually level against Christianity takes this form. They say that Christianity believes that it has the truth. And that kind of dogmatic commitment to what Christians believe is truth leads to conflict. It leads to bigotry. It leads to marginalizing people who are not part of the inside group. And oftentimes these days, the comparison is made to those men who flew the planes into the towers on 9/11. They thought they had the truth. See what it did for them? And so you Christians are the same way. You may not be flying planes into towers, but your bigotry, your smearing of people who do not believe like you do is just as evil, it's just as wrong, it's just as bad. And it always comes back to the fact that you Christians believe that you have the truth. And of course, the alternative that is offered to this, to Christians' devotion to the truth, is the idea that truth is relative. But everybody has their own version of the truth, and we ought to respect that. So I have my version of the truth, and Roy has his version of the truth, and Larry has his version of the truth, and we can just go around the room and go throughout the whole world. Everybody has their own version of the truth, and that's fine for them. And we ought to live and let live, and everybody just has their own truth and what they want to believe truth to be. How do we respond to that? Now, again, we have been conditioned growing up in the culture that we grew up in to respond. One verse in particular really stands out, does it not? What Jesus said in John 17, sanctify them in the truth. Your word is truth. So when people say, you think you have the truth, our response is we hold up the good book and say, here's the truth. This is God's word. This is the truth. You need to know this. And I'm not going to challenge that. But is this going to convince the critic? The critic says, yeah, I know. That's the problem. You think that the truth is in this book, and there is no other truth anywhere else. So that's what we need to understand, and that's how we're going to approach this. And what I'd like for us to do this morning is to respond to that by setting forth and trying to defend three simple propositions. First proposition, everyone believes in the truth. Second proposition, no one can live without the truth. And the third proposition is, the truth is personal. Now, none of those three propositions that I have just laid out make any sense at all. So let's plunge in, start working through these one by one, and see if we can make sense of this, and see if it provides some means of responding to the criticism that Christians believe they have the truth. So let's start with the first proposition, everyone believes in the truth. Now, you'll notice I did not say everyone believes in a truth. Now, that's the popular approach today. Everybody has their own truth, and yeah, everybody believes all of that. But that's not really what I'm saying here. What I'm saying is everyone believes in the truth, one singular definition of what is true, what is real, what is actual. Now, as we just noted, everybody indeed has a different definition of what that truth is. But here's the point. Whatever the definition an individual might hold, that person believes it with all the certitude, with all the finality of the most strident Christian fundamentalist. If you take the position that everybody is free to have their own version of the truth, okay, fine, but what is each individual going to do with that truth that they hold to? They're going to defend it. They're going to stand for it. They're going to stand against those who would challenge their version of the truth. And let me give you an example of this that we are struggling with in our own society today. In the area of human sexuality, why are those who are proponents of non-traditional behaviors, and I'm speaking here of specifically homosexuality, gay marriage, and more recently transgenderism, why are these people so vociferous in defending their behaviors? And you've heard it. You've been on the receiving end, no doubt, of people who criticize you for what you believe about biblical morality, and yet you have people throwing this their beliefs in your face that you're not there right and you are not right. You see, the issue here is not whether or not people believe they have the truth because they believe they do have the truth. The question is, which version of truth is valid? Which version of truth is correct? Those who believe in these non-traditional versions of human sexuality believe that they have a true understanding of human sexuality, namely that it's fluid, that it's open, that I can make it whatever I want it to be. And they want everybody else to accept and, in fact, to endorse their view of the truth. Now, I simply pose the question, what's the difference between that and the Christian who says, no, I have a different view of human sexuality? What's the difference? And you just go down the line to every kind of topic or subject or philosophical outlook on life that you want to consider, and you come down to pretty much the same point. Everybody, having their own version of truth, will defend their version of the truth. And that's why I think this first proposition stands. Regardless of what you consider the truth to be, what you think it to be, you will defend. You'll stand firm on that. Why should Christians be any different? You see, we're all in the same boat of having to figure out this world that we live in. What is life? What is my life about? And we all come up with answers to these questions. Christians have, yes, a view of truth that is centered in the Bible, and we believe strongly about that, but so does everybody else in their own version of the truth, whatever they think it to be. And they will defend it. And they will expect other people to embrace and endorse and accept their version of the truth. So, in this first proposition, we find that this criticism that's leveled against Christianity, that you people think you have the truth, really applies to everybody. Everyone who believes anything about anything faces the same challenge. And that challenge is, how can I know that my view of the truth, whatever it might be, is in fact valid? So, for that reason, it does not offend me at all when people come to me and wag a finger in my face and say, you Christians think you have the truth. I just say, well, do you think you have the truth? Define truth any way you want. I don't care. Just you define truth the way you want. Do you think you have the truth? Well, I think everybody ought to have their own truth and be able to do whatever they want. That statement is your statement of truth that you're willing to defend, that you believe is valid. Are you saying anybody disagrees with you is wrong? Then why am I being criticized for what I believe being the truth? You see what I'm saying here? And I'm not quoting any scripture here. All I'm trying to do is get people to understand, wait a minute, we have to make sense of this world in which we live. And yes, people have different perspectives on the truth. I get that. But whatever your perspective is on the truth, however you define that, you believe in the truth. Christians are no different than anybody else. Okay? So let's just recognize from the outset that we're all standing pretty much at the same starting point. We are all challenged to try to figure out and come to some kind of conclusion on how can I know that my view of the truth, whatever it might be, is in fact valid. And that brings us then to the second proposition that we want to consider, and that is that no one can live without the truth. Now again, we're leaving for the moment the definition of the truth open. But recognize that there are those, as we've just noted, who think that they have a unique perspective on the truth and that they want other people to adopt, to embrace, to accept. But we have to understand that no one can live without the truth. You can't just shrug off the truth as unknowable. Well, we just cannot know the truth. And so I just won't bother in trying to find out what the truth is. Once again, that very position is a truth claim, that I can't know what the truth is. But nobody lives that way. Everybody who lives on planet Earth has to recognize there's some kind of truth out there that I have to cooperate with. I have to live with. I have to learn to adjust myself and my life to that external truth. You see, it's really not possible for us. It is impossible for us to live in such a way that there is just simply a total disregard for truth, however you define it. The youngest child learns at a very early age that there's some truth in this world. Because once they start ignoring that truth, they get burned. They get hurt. And they figure out, I'd better adjust my life to the truth of this world that I live in. Truth, you see, is not something that we make up to suit ourselves. It's an external, objective standard of belief and behavior that everybody, sooner or later in their lives, has to learn to acknowledge and to follow, or else they're going to encounter disaster. Let's take, for example, the physical realm. Now, let's suppose that there's some good-hearted fellow who decides that he can fly by flapping his arms. Boys, can you do that? Can you fly by flapping your arms? And this guy decides, I'm going to prove it. And he goes to the Epic Center, downtown Wichita, and he goes up to the 22nd floor, top of that building. He stands on the ledge, and he starts flapping his arms, and he leaps off. And what's going to happen? Well, everybody chuckles because we know this is not going to turn out well. He just splats on the sidewalk and they scrape up the pieces and funeral will be in a couple of days. What happened? There are physical laws that we live in this world. Human beings were not designed to fly by flapping their arms. Now someone might say, well, he could have had a wingsuit on or he could have had a jetpack or something like that and then he could fly. Yeah, but even then, he would have to make sure that all his calculations were correct and the design of that wingsuit and the jetpack or whatever contraption that he uses in order to fly met the truth of certain physical laws. Or again, he would crash. Right? Okay, so there is truth in the physical realm, and we figure out very fast that you don't stick your hand in a fire. You don't jump off tall buildings without some way of helping you get down safely. You go to the doctor. The doctor does a physical, and he comes back and says, I have a warning for you. You need to change your diet, and you need to do more exercise, or you're going to die at an early age. Now, upon what is the doctor basing that prognostication, that warning? Well, he has examined your body and your habits, and he sees all the signs. He's done the blood work, and he recognizes you're not on a good path here. You are not treating your body well, and your body is responding accordingly, and you're headed for an early grave. You need to change your ways. What do you do? You go home and start gorging on junk food and sit in front of the television all day long. How's that going to turn out for you? Well, the doctor probably knows what he's talking about, and you're probably headed for an early grave. Now, is life being cruel to you? No. There are certain laws of biology that we have to recognize and we have to cooperate with. And if we choose to mistreat our bodies in some way, we're going to pay a price for that. And it's not because somebody arbitrarily imposed some kind of restriction on us to force us down that path. This is just the way the human body was designed to operate. And we have to recognize that and learn how to cooperate with these biological, physical truths of this world in which we live. Truth is, there is a physical nature in which we live that runs by certain laws or principles. Mankind did not create these laws. No authority, earthly authority, imposed these laws upon us. They are not subject to change or modification on our part. We just simply have to recognize that's the way this world is, and we have to respect that and live by it, or we are going to get burned. That's why I say no one can live without the truth. You just can't. Now, someone might say, okay, but David, everything you've talked about to this point has to do with the physical realm. In the physical material world, yeah, there are laws of nature that we have to recognize and we have to live by that or we damage ourselves. I get that. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about things relating to morals and the spiritual realm, psychology, who we are on the inside. There are no laws there. We ought to be able to make our own decisions, do our own thing, establish our own truth with regard to how we choose to live our lives in this area. Just as there is a physical nature that we live in, there is a human nature. How we operate, how we tick on the inside is just as much subject to certain laws and principles as our bodies on the outside. And we figure that out fairly quickly. For example, suppose two people get married. Now, let's suppose that these two people are ardent atheists. They do not believe in God. They do not believe in Christianity. They don't believe the Bible has any reference to them at all. But they get married, these two people. And they find out pretty quickly that in order for their marriage to work, what are they going to have to do? Well, they're going to have to learn, for example, the principle of self-sacrifice. This relationship is not all about me. I have to open my heart, my life, my time to the other person now in this relationship. Right? Even skeptics, atheists, recognize there are certain principles that apply to the functioning of a smooth relationship like that. And in marriage, they figure out that a marriage built on selfishness and lust is soon going to crumble. That applies to believers, atheists, everybody. Why? Because there is such a thing as human nature. Because what we are on the inside and how we order that in relation to other people is going to impact the quality of our relationships with other people. We figure out what it takes to make things work in our relationships with others. Consider the current debate that's going on today over the definition of gender. It is popular today to argue that gender is simply a social construct, and that, in fact, people cannot know what their gender is until they grow up and reach a certain age. Is it any surprise, is there any coincidence in the fact that in the transgender population, there is an extraordinarily high rate of mental illness and suicide? Now, someone might argue, well, that's because of the social ostracism that these people receive. You might could have said that 20 years ago, not anymore. No, the problem is that people are denying the biological truth of who they are. Human beings, like every other member of the biological kingdom, the animal kingdom, we are designed to mate in pairs, male and female. That's how we are born, and that's how we function effectively. That's just simply who we are. That is the nature of the world in which we live, both from the outside and from the inside. To the smallest piece of DNA in our bodies, we are designed for a certain purpose. And when, for whatever reason, we choose to deny that reality, that truth, then we're running into a brick wall at full speed. We're setting ourselves up for problems. At a fundamental level, we have to know who we are, why we are here, and how we are to live. And the answers that we come up with to those questions must fit our nature, how we were designed, how we were built, or our life is going to end up as a terrible mess. And when people deny that objective truth exists in the moral realm, they set themselves up for catastrophic failure. You may be familiar with C.S. Lewis. He was a very famous apologist for the Christian faith in the middle of the 20th century. He wrote a small book called The Abolition of Man, addressing this very subject of this very nebulous, subjective approach to trying to define truth and life. And here's how he described the problem that people get themselves into. He says, and I quote, "You cannot go on explaining away forever. You will find that you have explained explanation itself away. You cannot go on seeing through things forever. The whole point of seeing through something is to see something through it. It is good that the window should be transparent because the street or the garden beyond is opaque. But what if you saw through the garden too? If you see through everything, then everything is transparent. But a wholly transparent world is an invisible world. To see through all things is the same as to not see." And that's the state that our culture has come to. So many people claim that we can't know, that the truth is just so nebulous, it's so vague, and everybody has to be free to make their own truth and define truth wherever they can find it, whatever feels right to them. They're seeing through the laws of nature and the laws of human nature and saying, "I can't really know what the truth is." And this is not going to end well. There's a more recent philosopher, Doug Grutice, wrote a book a while back called Truth Decay, and he put it this way: if everything is a matter of interpretation or redescription or perspective all the way down, then there are no bedrock facts at all. No facts to relay and no facts to obscure. One's words create all the reality we can ever know. Notice this. The clear consequence of such a view is that lies are non-existent because they are impossible. Lies are non-existent because they're impossible. If our view of truth is such that we really cannot know, that there is any kind of objective truth out there, a reality that's separate and apart from ourselves, and that we have to align our lives with that reality, if we deny that that exists out there, how in the world can you define what a lie is? There's no such thing as a lie. Why? Because there's no such thing as truth. You have to have truth before you can have a lie. Remember a couple of weeks ago we were talking about the lies that we tell ourselves? And the damage that we do to ourselves because somehow inside we get our thinking all twisted up and we convince ourselves of things that are not true. And as a result, we end up hurting ourselves. But this is precisely what the modern concept, the postmodern concept of truth is doing to people and their lives. If we convince ourselves there is no truth, we open ourselves up to every lie in the book. We'll believe anything. And why not? Let's go to the Bible. Turn back to this passage that Larry read in Isaiah 59. I have used this passage before, but because it has become my favorite description from the Bible of what our modern culture has become. Now, we just read three verses from this chapter. I'm going to read a few more, but let's start with the three, verses 4, 14, and 15. And did you notice what Isaiah is addressing in these verses? No one calls for justice, nor does any plead for truth. They trust in empty words and speak lies. They conceive evil and bring forth iniquity. In verse 14, justice is turned back and righteousness stands afar off. Why? For truth is fallen in the street and equity cannot enter. So truth fails, and he who departs from evil makes himself a prey. Then the Lord saw it, and it displeased him that there was no justice. I want you to notice here, the first line in this reading, what does it say? Verse 4, no one calls for justice, nor does any plead for truth. Look at the last line in verse 15. After truth fails, God sees there was no justice. We have so many people in our society today that are crying out for justice. We need justice in our society. Social justice warriors, they call themselves. And by denying that there is an objective truth, they have destroyed the very foundation of justice. And we're going to talk more about justice in our lesson next week. I'm not going to pursue this at any great extent now. But I want you to see there's a connection between how we view truth, how we define truth, how we build our lives around truth, and the presence or the absence of justice in society. A just and prosperous and stable civil society cannot exist where people have basically thrown truth under the bus. You'll notice in this passage that God does recognize that people are speaking lies. Problem is, they don't know it, because they've denied that there is any truth at all. And as Dr. Grutai says, if there is no truth, there can be no lies, because everybody's doing their own thing. Why, if you follow politics at all especially, why is our political life today so coarse, so divisive, so full of hatred and venom, and so polarizing? People just cannot seem to agree on anything anymore. Let's read some more here in Isaiah 59. I think we'll find the answer. We read verse 4, look at verse 5. They hatch viper's eggs and weave the spider's web. He who eats of their eggs dies. From that which is crushed, a viper breaks out. Their webs will not become garments, nor will they cover themselves with their works. Their works are works of iniquity, and the act of violence is in their hands. Their feet run to evil, and they make haste to shed innocent blood. Their thoughts are thoughts of iniquity. Wasting and destruction are in their paths. The way of peace they have not known, and there is no justice in their ways. They have made themselves crooked paths, and whoever takes that way shall not know peace. Therefore, justice is far from us, nor does righteousness overtake us. We look for light, but there is darkness. For brightness, but we walk in blackness. We grope for the wall like the blind, and we grope as if we had no eyes. We stumble at noonday as at twilight. We are as dead men in desolate places. We all growl like bears and moan sadly like doves. We look for justice, but there is none. For salvation, but it is far from us. This is a society in collapse, and this was 700 years before Christ. And what did Isaiah put his finger on and said, this is the problem. This is where it all originates. Because there was no truth anymore. You cannot live without truth. You rip truth from your life and say, I'll just make up my own. You're free to do that. But you're going to pay a price for that. We are all paying a price for that. Nobody is happy. We're growling like bears. We grope about in the dark. We don't know which way to turn, what's going wrong in our lives. And that brings us then to the third proposition that we want to consider. And that is that the truth is personal. Now, wait a minute. David, you've been arguing here for the last 30 minutes that truth is objective. It is out there. It's outside ourselves. It's not within us. course, that's not what I'm referring to here. If everyone embraces a dogmatic belief in some version of the truth, whatever it might be, and if some of those versions can be disastrous, as we have just seen, then how can we know what version of truth is the one that we should follow? And Christianity argues that the truth that we ought to follow, that we ought to recognize, is real and actual, is a person. That's how we know what truth is. That's where we find the truth that we build our lives upon. It's not that each person has his or her own truth. It's rather the fact that truth as we view it is not some kind of philosophical abstraction. We see truth as personified in Jesus Christ. He is our truth. And is this not what Jesus himself said? I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father except through me. What do we mean by that? In Jesus Christ, we see a perfect model of what humanity ought to be. Of what we ought to be. Not what we'd like to be, not what we'd prefer to be, or what feels good to be, but rather of what we ought to be. This is what we were made to be. And what is that? Look at Jesus. Look at the life and teachings of this man. His life and what he taught can be summed up in the saying, it is more blessed to give than to receive, right? This is how Paul summed up the work of Jesus. It's more blessed to give than to receive. We as human beings were created to give to others, to serve others, to help others, to show compassion to others. We were not put on this earth to get, to take, to be served, to hoard for ourselves. And when we make that our purpose in life, when that becomes our truth, we get hurt. It damages us. It damages the people around us. Jesus said, look at me. I'll show you how to do it the right way. And when you look at what this man taught and how he lived his life and how it was entirely a life of service to others, then we begin to get an idea. That's what life is about. That's the way I ought to live my life. That's the way I ought to make the decisions that I have to make in this life. But it didn't end there. In his death and his resurrection from the dead, Jesus gave us a graphic demonstration of that principle in action. He loved us so much that he was willing to give himself for us. He gave himself so that others could live. Does that define your life? Is that how you make your decisions? As to how you spend your time, your resources? So how does that govern your relationship with others? And you know what is so ironic about this? When you just look at the life and the death and the resurrection of Jesus, somebody giving himself for others, everybody recognizes the goodness in that. How many times do we see the story of somebody who runs into a burning building, he jumps into a freezing body of water, or he throws himself on a hand grenade or whatever in order to save other people around him? And we look at that and we admire that. And we say, how noble, how brave, how uplifting, how empowering, how humanizing. Jesus took that to another level. Do Christians believe that we have the truth? Well, I recognize there are a lot of details that we don't always agree on. But let me tell you one thing. There's one thing that we can point to with an ironclad certainty. That somebody loved us so much that he was willing to give himself for us. And because he did that, it has changed our lives. How we look at our own lives and what we want to use our lives for. If you want to understand truth, simply study the story of Jesus of Nazareth. And you'll find all the truth you ever wanted to build your life upon. Jesus said on one occasion, "You shall know the truth, and the truth will make you free." The truth that Christianity espouses does not imprison people in a dungeon of rules and regulations. I know it can be abused. We've all seen plenty of examples of that. But true Christianity, the original version of Christianity, liberates people. It frees them to live the life that they were designed by their Creator to live. Do you want that? Do you want something solid that you can build your life upon? Then why not come to the Lord today? Build your life upon Him, and you will have the peace that your heart desires. You need to respond. Won't you come now as we stand and sing?